Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 2nd, Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, Polis Issues Health Orders by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Congressional Map Approved Keeps Incumbent Advantages by Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Supreme Court Justices Question Texas's Abortion Law by Mark Sherman and Jessica Gresko. And COVID-19, Vaccine for Younger Kids Are Being Packed and Shipped by Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar, the Associated Press, and following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19, Polis issues health orders. Cosmetic surgeries must be halted as the virus strains Colorado hospitals by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Colorado's COVID-19 hospitalizations continued rising over the weekend as Governor Jared Polis issued multiple public health orders to try to save beds, including one that halted cosmetic procedures for a month. As of Monday afternoon, 1,236 people were hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19, and 90 others were receiving care and being tested for the virus. The last time more people were receiving hospital care for the virus was December 22nd, less than 3 weeks after the state hit its all-time peak at 1,995 hospitalizations for confirmed or suspected COVID-19. While the number of people hospitalized for COVID-19 is lower than it was at the December peak, the state has fewer beds available because more people are seeking care for other severe health problems, and some staff have gone on to other states or left the health field. Last week, Polis said that the state would take action in the coming days if trends didn't improve. He laid out 5 possible options for dealing with the shortage of hospital beds: expanding access to a COVID-19 treatment to reduce the odds of hospitalization, taking control of the transfer process in order to use all available beds, calling on the Federal Emergency Management Agency for staffing help, stopping all elective procedures, and implementing crisis standards of care, which could involve care rationing or less than ideal staffing patterns in hospitals. Trends haven't improved much since then. Last week's total number of new coronavirus cases was at its highest level since mid-December, and while the percentage of tests coming back positive dropped somewhat over the weekend, it remained elevated. The higher the positivity rate is, the more likely it is that the state's not finding cases. Both the case counts and the positivity rate point to continued high levels of spread in the community, said Talia Quandalesi, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Colorado School of Public Health. As hospitals fill up, the state is approaching a crisis point, she said. Given the high level of transmission, everyone should mask up in indoor public places and consider some social distancing, though it's most critical for unvaccinated people, Quandalesi said. It's also important to get tested if you have symptoms, especially ahead of the winter holidays, she said. The situation shows that we need additional layers of protection, she said. Having a safe holiday requires more than just people being vaccinated. State officials have indicated they won't consider requiring masks in most settings or reinstating capacity limits on businesses or at gatherings. On Thursday, the state announced it would expand treatment starting this week. Sunday's executive orders by Polis take control of the hospital transfer process and partially limit elective surgeries. So far, the state hasn't activated any crisis standards of care in this wave, though one of the weekend orders amending the governor's disaster declaration would pave the way for it to do so. The order on cosmetic procedures took effect Monday and expires December 1st. It applies to hospitals and to outpatient surgery centers, but only covers a fraction of all elective procedures. Any surgery that can be scheduled, ranging from knee replacements to removing tumors, is considered elective. Polis had floated the possibility of delaying all non-emergency procedures, as the state did last year, at a news conference last week. There is an exception for cosmetic surgeries that have to happen in the next 6 months to prevent a person from dying or losing significant physical functioning. That would seem to leave the door open for certain reconstructive surgeries, which may have a cosmetic component, but also are intended to repair an injury. The state didn't release an estimate of how many beds might be freed up by halting cosmetic procedures. Some hospitals have been triaging surgeries for weeks, delaying those where the patient is less likely to suffer permanent harm. A separate order, also released Sunday, gave the state more power to direct hospital transfers by forbidding hospitals to refuse to accept a patient they have the capacity to treat, or to refuse to send the patient to a different facility. Patients could also be transferred against their will if their preferred hospital is full. Polis had said last week that hospitals were trying to keep patients within their own system, but didn't specify how often that had happened. Another order required counties to consult with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment about additional restrictions if at least 85% of their hospital beds are full in the next month, but didn't specify what those restrictions might be or if the state would choose to enforce them. It also required almost everyone, 12 and older, to wear masks in long-term care homes, medical facilities, and correctional buildings. Previously, only unvaccinated people were required to mask up in those settings. A fourth executive order issued Sunday required vaccine providers to give second shots to anyone who is eligible, even if they didn't give the first shot, and to give boosters to anyone who says they qualify. That order didn't have a sunset date. Congressional map approved keeps incumbent advantages by Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Colorado's Supreme Court on Monday unanimously approved redrawn congressional district lines that are to stand for the next decade. The map the court approved was workshopped by an independent redistricting commission comprised of 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and 4 unaffiliated voters. That was a new model for the state, and it was meant to reduce the chance of partisan gerrymandering. This map preserves partisan advantages for all 7 of Colorado's incumbent members of Congress, Republicans Lauren Boebert, Ken Buck, and Doug Lamborn, plus Democrats Jason Crow, Diana DeGette, Joe Neguse, and Ed Perlmutter. Colorado will also have a new 8th congressional district awarded as a result of population growth over the last decade. That district will cover the North Denver suburbs, with no particular advantage for either major party. The Supreme Court heard from some who argued the new map is unfair in that it dilutes Latino voting power. Others argued it's not right for a state where Democrats are so dominant they control all levels of statewide politics to have a congressional map that could plausibly split 4-4 after next year's election. The court's ruling took note of the new process for creating the map. For the first time, the state's congressional district map is not the product of politics or litigation. It is instead the product of public input, transparent deliberation, and compromise among 12 ordinary voters representing the diversity of our state. The plan surely will not please everyone, but again, the question before us is not whether the commission adopted a perfect redistricting plan. The Supreme Court is in the process of reviewing two other proposed maps, one for new state House district lines and another for new state Senate district lines. The court's decision on the legislative maps is expected later this month. Supreme Court. Justices question Texas's abortion law by Mark Sherman and Jessica Gresko, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. A majority of the Supreme Court signaled Monday they would allow abortion providers to pursue a court challenge to a Texas law that has virtually ended abortion in the nation's second largest state after 6 weeks of pregnancy. But it was unclear how quickly the court would rule and whether it would issue an order blocking the law that has been in effect for 2 months or require providers to ask a lower court to put the law on hold. Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, two conservative appointees of former President Donald Trump, voted in September to allow the law to take effect, but they raised questions Monday about its novel structure. The law, written to make it difficult to mount legal challenges, subjects clinics, doctors, and any others who facilitate abortions to large financial penalties. Millions and millions retroactively imposed, even though the activity was perfectly lawful under court orders and precedent at the time it was undertaken, right? Kavanaugh asked one of several skeptical questions he put to Judd E. Stone II, representing Texas. Barrett, too, pressed Stone about provisions of the law that force providers to fight lawsuits one by one, and she said, don't allow their constitutional rights to be fully aired. The justices heard 3 hours of arguments Monday in two cases over whether abortion providers or the Justice Department can mount federal court challenges to the law, which has an unusual enforcement scheme. Its defenders argue shields it from federal court review. The Biden administration filed its lawsuit after the justices voted 5-4 to refuse a request by providers to keep the law on hold. Justice Neil Gorsuch, also a Trump appointee, and two other conservative justices joined Barrett and Kavanaugh in the majority to let the law take effect. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's three liberal justices in dissent. The justices sounded less convinced that the Justice Department lawsuit should go forward, and Justice Elena Kagan suggested that a ruling instead in favor of the providers would allow the court to avoid difficult issues of federal power. In neither case, argued Monday, is the right to an abortion directly at issue. But the motivation for the lawsuits is that the Texas law conflicts with landmark Supreme Court rulings that prevent a state from banning abortion early in pregnancy. Arguing for the United States, Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger told the justices that Texas's law was enacted in open defiance of Supreme Court precedent. It enacted a law that clearly violates this court's precedents, she said. Under the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision and 1992 Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, states are prevented from banning abortions before viability, the point at which a fetus can survive outside the womb, around 24 weeks of pregnancy. The justices will hear a separate challenge to those decisions in a case over Mississippi's ban on abortion after 15 weeks. Those arguments are set for December 1st. The most direct reference to the Mississippi case came from Justice Samuel Alito, who asked if the decision by providers to stop doing abortions in Texas is attributed to the fear of liability if Roe or Casey is altered. But most questions focused on the Texas law and how it has altered abortion in the state even before the high court has made any change in abortion law. Kagan told Stone that until Texas passed its law, no state dreamed of trying to make an end run around Supreme Court precedent in the same way. If the Supreme Court doesn't do anything about that, she said, it would be inviting states to try to flout precedent. Guns, same-sex marriage, religious rights, whatever you don't like, go ahead, she said. Kagan, who disagreed with her colleague's decision to let the law take effect, said Texas's law has prevented women in Texas from exercising a constitutional right. Kavanaugh also raised concerns about laws that might affect other constitutional rights. The Texas law has been in effect since September, when the Supreme Court declined to intervene, except for a 48-hour period in early October when it was blocked by a lower court. The High Court got involved again less than 2 weeks ago, moving at extraordinary speed. The court offered no explanation for its decision to hear the cases so quickly. If the court allows the providers to continue their lawsuit, it would still take a separate order from the justices or a lower court to put the law on hold. Amy Hagstrom Miller, chief executive of Whole Women's Health, said her four clinics would resume abortion services if they get a favorable court order. The Texas ban, signed into law by Governor Greg Abbott in May, prohibits abortion after cardiac activity is detected in a fetus, usually around 6 weeks, and before some women know they are pregnant. The law makes exceptions for medical emergencies, but not for rape or incest. A study published by researchers at the University of Texas found that the number of abortions statewide fell by 50% after the law took effect in September, compared to the same month in 2020. The study was based on data from 19 of the state's 24 abortion clinics, according to the Texas Policy Evaluation Project. At least 12 other states have enacted bans early in pregnancy, but all have been blocked from going into effect. Rather than have state officials enforce the law, Texas deputizes private citizens to sue anyone who performs or aids and abets an abortion. If someone bringing suit is successful, they are entitled to at least $10,000. Women who obtain abortions can't be sued under the law. During arguments Monday, Roberts at one point asked whether the law could be challenged if Texas had made the entitlement much higher, $1 million. Texas's lawyer told him no. The structure of the law threatens abortion providers with huge financial penalties if they violate it. Clinics throughout the state have stopped performing abortions once cardiac activity is found. The result, both the providers and the Biden administration said, is that women who are financially able have traveled to other states, and those without the means must either continue their pregnancies against their will or find other, potentially dangerous ways to end them. Stone and Jonathan Mitchell, an architect of the law, who also argued Monday, defended the law and its unusual structure. They said both the providers and the Justice Department lack the right to go into federal court and should be asking Congress, not the justices, to expand court access. COVID-19, vaccine for younger kids are being packed and shipped by Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Anticipating a green light from vaccine advisors, the Biden administration is assembling and shipping millions of COVID-19 shots for children ages 5 to 11, the White House said Monday. The first could go into kids' arms by midweek. We are not waiting on the operations and logistics, said coronavirus coordinator Jeff Zients. By vaccinating children, the U.S. hopes to head off another coronavirus wave during the cold weather months when people spend more time indoors and respiratory illnesses can spread more easily. Cases have been declining for weeks, but the virus has repeatedly shown its ability to stage a comeback, and more easily transmissible mutations are a persistent threat. On Tuesday, a special advisory panel to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will meet to consider detailed recommendations for administering the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to younger children. The Food and Drug Administration already cleared the shots, which deliver about one-third of the vaccine given to adults. After CDC advisors make their recommendations, agency director Dr. Rochelle Walensky will give the final order. Zients said the government has enough of the Pfizer vaccine for all 28 million children in the 5 to 11 age group. We're in great shape on supply, Zients said during the White House coronavirus briefing. The children's vaccination drive is expected to start later this week and go into full swing by next week. Parents will be able to go to vaccines.gov and filter on vaccines for children 5 to 11 to find a location near them that is offering the shot. Pfizer's vaccine already has been authorized for use in older children. After the FDA gave its authorization for younger children, the Biden administration asked states, territories, and other jurisdictions to place their initial orders. Workers at the drug company and at distribution centers began the process of preparing and packing 15 million doses, said Zients. More doses will be packed and shipped and delivered, he added. More and more vaccine will come online as we ramp up. The goal is for parents to have a range of options for getting children vaccinated, from pediatricians' offices to clinics and pharmacies. Walensky acknowledged both a sense of urgency and concern about getting children vaccinated. She stressed that clinical trials of the Pfizer vaccine for children have found it highly effective in preventing serious disease, with no severe adverse reactions in safety and efficacy trials. There has been a great deal of anticipation from parents, Walensky said. I encourage parents to ask questions. Separately, Zients announced that about 70% of U.S. adults are now fully vaccinated, while 80% have received at least one vaccine dose. Climate Summit in Scotland. Biden, U.S. has obligations, by Ellen Kickmeyer, Zeke Miller, and Josh Bowock, The Associated Press, byline Glasgow, Scotland. In a markedly more humble tone for a U.S. leader, President Joe Biden acknowledged at a UN summit Monday that the United States and other energy-gulping developed nations bear much of the responsibility for climate change, and said actions taken this decade to contain global warming will be decisive in preventing future generations from suffering. None of us can escape the worst that has yet to come if we fail to seize this moment, Biden declared. The president treated the already visible crisis for the planet, flooding, volatile weather, droughts, and wildfires, as a unique opportunity to reinvent the global economy. Standing before world leaders gathered in Scotland, he sought to portray the enormous costs of limiting emissions from coal, oil, and natural gas as a chance to create jobs by transitioning to renewable energy and electric automobiles. Yet he also apologized for former President Donald Trump's decision to leave the Paris Agreement and the role the U.S. and other wealthy countries played in contributing to climate change. Those of us who are responsible for much of the deforestation and all of the problems we have so far, Biden said, have overwhelming obligations to the poorer nations that account for few of the emissions, yet are paying a price as the planet has grown hotter. As for Trump's action, Biden said, I shouldn't apologize, but I do apologize for the fact the United States, the last administration, pulled out of the Paris Accords and put us sort of behind the eight ball a little bit. His words in seemingly impromptu comments appear to break from past comments of many U.S. leaders who either made little mention of U.S. responsibility for the warming Earth or, as Biden himself did on the eve of the climate summit, blamed China as the world's current biggest emitter of climate-wrecking coal and petroleum fumes. Over history, scientists say, it's the United States that has pumped out the most climate-damaging pollution of any nation, as coal, diesel, and gasoline powered the United States and other developed nations to wealth. Biden, who briefly closed his eyes at one point during the speeches, used the summit to announce he planned to work with the U.S. Congress to provide $3 billion annually to help poorer countries and communities cope with climate damage, as developing nations increasingly are demanding of established, wealthier economies. Leaders Dial Up Doomsday Warning While Kickstarting Climate Talks by Seth Borenstein, The Associated Press, Byline, Glasgow, Scotland. World leaders turned up the heat and resorted to end-of-the-world rhetoric Monday in an attempt to bring new urgency to sputtering international climate negotiations. The metaphors were dramatic and mixed at the start of the talks, known as COP26. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson described global warming as a doomsday device strapped to humanity. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told his colleagues that humans are digging our own graves. And Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley, speaking for vulnerable island nations, added moral thunder, warning leaders not to allow the path of greed and selfishness to sow the seeds of our common destruction. Amid the speeches, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said his coal-dependent country will aim to stop adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by 2070, 2 decades after the United States, and at least 10 years later than China. Modi said the goal of reaching net zero by 2070 was one of 5 measures India planned to undertake to meet its commitments under the Paris Climate Accord. In a recorded welcome message, Queen Elizabeth II said she hoped the conference would be one of those rare occasions where everyone will have the chance to rise above the politics of the moment. History has shown that when nations come together in common cause, there is always room for hope, she said in the video, which was recorded on Friday at Windsor Castle. One of the United Nations' biggest concerns is that some countries are more focused on amorphous long-term net zero goals instead of seeking cuts this decade that could prevent temperature increases that would exceed the Paris goal. While 2070 sounds far off for India's pledge, 4 outside experts from think tanks and universities said India's new short and long-term goals are significant, while not huge, because of that nation's development status. Ulka Kelkar, who directs India climate policy analysis for the World Resource Institute, said a lot depends on details, but the 2070 goal would be similar to the U.S. and Europe, adopting net zero goals 20 years ago. Domestic policy proposal. Manchin wavers on Biden's plan. Dems vow to push on. By Lisa Mascaro and Farnoosh Amiri, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Senator Joe Manchin wavered Monday on his support for President Joe Biden's sweeping $1.75 trillion domestic policy proposal, saying instead it's time to vote on a slimmer $1 trillion infrastructure package that has stalled amid talks. The West Virginia Democrats' announcement comes as Democrats want a signal from Manchin that he will support Biden's big package. He's one of 2 key holdout senators whose votes are needed to secure the deal and push it toward passage. Instead, Manchin rebuffed progressive Democrats, urging them to quit holding hostage the smaller public works bill as negotiations continue on the broader package. Enough is enough, Manchin said at a hastily called press conference at the Capitol. Manchin said he's open to voting for a final bill reflecting Biden's big package that moves our country forward, but he said he's equally open to voting against the final product as he assesses the sweeping social services and climate change bill. Democrats have been working frantically to finish up Biden's signature domestic package after months of negotiations, racing toward a first round of House votes possible later this week. The White House swiftly responded that it remains confident Manchin will support Biden's plan, and congressional leaders indicated votes were on track as planned. Senator Manchin says he is prepared to support a Build Back Better plan that combats inflation, is fiscally responsible, and will create jobs, said Press Secretary Jen Psaki in a statement. As a result, we remain confident that the plan will gain Senator Manchin's support. The stakes are high, with Biden overseas at a global climate change summit and his party fighting in 2 key governor's races this week, in Virginia and New Jersey, that are seen as bellwethers in the political mood of the electorate. With Republicans staunchly opposed and no votes to spare, Democrats have been trying to unite progressive and centrist lawmakers around Biden's big vision. Progressives have been refusing to vote on the smaller public works bill, using it as leverage as they try to win commitments from Manchin and Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, the other key holdout, for Biden's broader bill. Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington, the leader of the Progressive Caucus, indicated her group is ready to push ahead and pass both bills this week in the House. She said she trusts that Biden will have the support needed for eventual Senate passage. "I would urge everybody to keep tempers down," Jayapal said on CNN. "We are preparing to pass through the House both bills in the president's agenda." House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer both echoed the White House, suggesting the bills are on track. Manchin, though, in a direct response to the progressives' tactics, said, "Holding this bill hostage won't work to get my support for the broader one." He said he will not support a bill that is this consequential without thoroughly understanding the impact it has on the economy and federal debt. Manchin's priority has long been the smaller public works bill of roads, highways, and broadband projects that had already been approved by the Senate, but is being stalled by House progressives as the broader negotiations are underway. Election Day. Tight Virginia race becoming referendum on Biden, by Sarah Rankin and Will Wiesert, the Associated Press, bylined Richmond, Virginia. A closely contested race for governor in Virginia entered its final hours Monday, with Democrat Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin both hoping for last-minute momentum in a campaign that's emerging as a referendum on Joe Biden's presidency. McAuliffe, who served as governor from 2014 to 2018, is scrambling to stave off disaster in a state that has become reliable Democratic territory in recent years. Biden carried Virginia by a comfortable 10 percentage points last year, but Youngkin's campaign is optimistic about his prospects of becoming the first Republican to win a statewide race since 2009. "This is a moment for Virginians to push back on this left, liberal, progressive agenda," Youngkin, a former private equity executive, told a rally at an airport hangar outside Richmond. Voters were also poised to decide a New Jersey governor's race Tuesday, as well as mayoral elections in many of the nation's top cities. Also, a ballot question that could remake policing in Minneapolis after George Floyd's death there last summer could have national implications. But the political repercussions were farthest reaching in Virginia, where McAuliffe again offered a message he's repeated throughout the campaign, that his opponent will bring former President Donald Trump's divisive style of politics to an increasingly blue state. "I'm closing my campaign with you in Richmond," McAuliffe said during his own swing through the state capitol. He is closing his campaign with Donald Trump. Really? That was a reference to the former president holding a Virginia Tala rally Monday night, though Youngkin himself wasn't planning to participate. Except for promises to safeguard election integrity, a nod to Trump's lies about last year's presidential race being stolen, Youngkin has done his best to eschew help not only from the former president, but also most top national GOP leaders. Doing so has allowed him to court moderate Republicans and swing voters. Another name not appearing on Tuesday's ballot is Biden's, but his approval ratings have fallen in recent weeks, and his administration will likely get a lot of blame nationally if its party doesn't prevail in Virginia. The Democratic-controlled Congress has yet to approve a major public works bill or a sweeping spending package that would dramatically increase government support for the social safety net, providing still more potential political headwinds against McAuliffe. Still, some Youngkin supporters credited their preferred candidate with keeping the race focused on Virginia, not Washington. "He's a straight shooter," said Dan Malloy, a 53-year-old small business owner. "He cares about the issues that we care about. You know, it's food on the table. What's the cost of groceries? What's the cost of gas? What do we need to do to move Virginia forward?" Early voting in Virginia, which has been dramatically expanded during the past 2 years of unified Democratic control of state government, ended this past weekend. Legislation passed in 2020 eliminated the need to provide one of a certain number of limited excuses to vote absentee, allowing any qualified voter to cast a ballot starting 45 days before the election. More than 1.1 million out of the state's approximately 5.9 million registered voters cast early ballots. That's down sharply from the 2.8 million early votes in last year's presidential election, but marks a dramatic increase when compared with about 195,000 early votes during the last gubernatorial cycle, before the voting reforms were instituted. State legislature. Governor wants record $40 billion budget, by Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Governor Jared Polis on Monday laid out his desires for a $40 billion budget in fiscal year 2022-23, a 4% increase from this year and a state record. The amount of money in the budget is dictated by economic conditions, not the governor's own politics. Such growth in next year's budget is possible as a result of the state's faster-than-expected recovery from the pandemic-induced recession of 2020. Just last year, Polis signed a 2020-2021 budget of only $30 billion. The total was later adjusted upward, as state analysts were warning of more lean budgets to come. But their dire predictions have not come true. In September, state economic analysts told the Legislative Joint Budget Committee that they project the state legislature will have $15.3 billion to spend out of the general fund, which covers education and healthcare spending, among other areas, for the fiscal year that ends June 30th. That's a 7.2% increase from last fiscal year, and the analysts forecast increases of about 4% through at least the 2023-24 budget. Polis touted his proposed budget for the 2022-23 fiscal year as being responsive to voter concerns. It's about tax and fee relief. It's about reducing crime. It's about reducing homelessness. It's about making more housing opportunities affordable for Coloradans, he said. Our whole budget is oriented around meeting the needs of where people are and helping to solve problems to improve the quality of life in Colorado. The proposal is far from guaranteed to be adopted because the legislature, not Polis, writes the budget. Lawmakers return to the Capitol in January and should finalize the 2022-23 budget in early spring. By that time, it's possible, likely even, that state economists will have released new forecasts that alter the total amount of money state government can spend. Here are some of the highlights from the governor's proposal. $2 billion set aside in general fund reserves, often referred to as rainy day cash for the state. An extra $1 billion, 8% increase, in money available for the legislature to spend out of the general fund. An increase in per pupil state funding of $526, up to about $9,500 apiece at the K-12 level. $600 million in relief money for employers for unemployment insurance payments during the pandemic. $530 million over 3 years for dozens of health projects and programs for people served by Medicaid. $424 million to address Colorado's poor air quality, including $255 million for rapidly greening our transportation system and school buses in particular. $200 million in new state funding to support cities in a homelessness crisis. $175 million in new housing investments meant to largely to spur the development of affordable places for people to live. A $113 million public safety package Polis hopes will reduce crime and recidivism. $48 million in that package will go to behavioral health initiatives to prevent crime and help people get mental health care and addiction treatment. $104 million in business fee relief, including $17 million in waived fees related to opening a new business. $30 million to create new child care facilities. $2.5 million to create the Colorado Equity Office, which the governor said will employ 19 full-time staff responsible for creating an equitable, diverse, and inclusive work environment throughout the state. A 3% across-the-board wage increase for state employees, who for the first time this year were allowed to engage in collective bargaining against the state. In many cases, Polis is relying on federal American Rescue Plan Act money to pay for his priorities. He told reporters Monday that the federal aid represents a once-in-a-generation opportunity for the state. Housing shortages. Communities are turning to ballot initiatives. By Jennifer Steinhauer, The New York Times Company, byline Leadville. A small business owner in a town fueled by vacationers is an unconventional proponent for a tax increase on tourists, but Marcy Lundin sees few other choices. Gearing up for ski season at her restaurant along the main drag of this fabled mining town perched at 10,000 feet between clusters of resorts, she is going to have trouble finding workers, she said, because few of them can afford to live in Leadville anymore. I don't look at this politically. I look at it economically, said Lundin, co-owner of the Golden Burrow. A sign in the window promotes a ballot measure Tuesday that would charge visitors staying at hotels, motels, and short-term rentals a 3% tax, earmarked to create more affordable housing. I have several potential employees not able to work for us because there is no place to live. That was a motivating factor, she said. The Leadville Initiative is one of nearly a dozen measures that will be on the ballot in Colorado to address the state's growing housing shortage, one that predates but now mirrors hundreds of communities around the nation. Numerous other counties and towns, especially in the West, are mulling similar initiatives on Tuesday's ballot, as housing stock remains scarce and prices remain high. Years of stalled building, labor, and supply problems, and the rise of short-term rentals like Airbnb, have all contributed to the housing shortage, which has frustrated first-time buyers, squeezed renters, and contributed to homelessness. Migration patterns during the coronavirus pandemic have worsened the problem in some places as people shift from more expensive cities to new areas, boosting prices as they alight in search of the closest Trader Joe's. The median existing home price was $352,800 in September, up 13.3% from the same period last year, and the 115th straight month of year-over-year increases, according to the National Association of Realtors. Voters in three cities in Colorado will decide this week whether to approve excise or accommodations taxes on short-term rentals that would go toward new housing, while Vail and Crested Butte, high-end resort towns, will vote on a sales tax that would also go to new housing initiatives. In Lincoln County, Oregon, the only item on the ballot this week would require the phasing out of short-term rental homes in unincorporated residential areas and place other restrictions on those properties. Other cities are contemplating similar measures to rein in Airbnb-style rentals, which they believe have priced out residents from long-term housing. Airbnb disputed that finding. As a number of experts have concluded, home sharing has little impact on housing affordability and is not a factor in housing supply, said Sam Randall, a spokesman for Airbnb. In St. Paul, Minnesota, residents will vote on a rent control measure, an issue that has become central to the mayor's race in Boston as well. Tram Hoang, manager of the Keep St. Paul Home campaign in Minnesota, said, "We have felt the crunch as rental and purchasing home prices rise. Under the proposal, St. Paul would cap annual rent increases to 3%. Other voters around the country, like those in Albuquerque, will weigh in on new bonds that would finance the construction and rehabilitation of low and moderate income housing. Political groups across the spectrum are carefully watching how these initiatives fare, so we can plan statewide ballot measures in 2022, said Corinne Rivera Fowler, the Director of Policy and Legal Advocacy for the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, which consults on initiatives. Economic justice in general has kind of risen up during the pandemic, and put a spotlight on the issues that folks are dealing with in order to afford to live with dignity. Many initiatives were indeed prompted by residents weary of the housing hunt. The housing shortage in Leadville squeezes all the little people that hold up this town and county, said Jenny David, 43, a seamstress who joined the Lake County Housing Coalition, which is leading the initiative to increase taxes on tourists. David has bounced from an apartment building to a modular home as rents have gone up. She now fears the duplex she landed through word of mouth may be sold in this overheated market. I feel like I had some real-world experience to bring, she said. Like many places near vacation spots, Lake County, where Leadville sits, has seen its real estate market value more than double over the past 5 years. But there has been little investment in housing for low-income workers in the area, officials there say. Proponents of the measure in Oregon's Lincoln County also blame short-term rentals for the shortage of available housing. In some areas of the county, housing was so scarce last summer that an area hospital asked residents to rent homes to nurses and other medical staff. Homes that were purchased to essentially turn into short-term rental properties have converted neighborhoods into short-term rental resorts, where 5% to 45% of the housing is now short-term, said Monica Kirk, a leader of 15 Neighborhoods, which was formed during the pandemic by a group of local residents and sponsored the initiative to phase out short-term rentals in some areas. We felt we needed to preserve our neighborhoods and restore our depleted long-term housing stock. Denver's initiated Ordinance 303. Judge strikes down part of measure, by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. A key component of initiated Ordinance 303, which seeks to build on Denver's camping ban and give residents the authority to sue the city if it does not address encampments on a strict timeline, was struck down Sunday night before votes on the measure have been counted as part of the November 2nd election. Denver District Court Judge Daryl Shockley issued his ruling at 9:03 p.m. Sunday. He ruled in favor of the city, which sued in October to block a section of the ordinance that would have mandated the city must take action within 72 hours, 3 days, after receiving a complaint from a resident about encampments, people experiencing homelessness. The city, in its lawsuit against Garrett Flicker, the chairman of the Denver Republican Party, who brought the measure to the 2021 ballot, argued the 72-hour requirement would infringe on the city's authority to carry out administrative functions of enforcing its laws. Shockley agreed, writing in his opinion, mandatory enforcement of the unauthorized camping ordinance based solely upon complaint impinges on the necessary discretion entrusted to law enforcement to ensure that suspects are afforded constitutional protections and the UCO remains constitutional as applied. The 72-hour mandate would also prevent police from prioritizing responses to other reported illegal activity in the city, Shockley added. In the same order, Shockley also ruled against a motion filed by Flicker seeking to dismiss the city's lawsuit. Flicker got the language of the ordinance approved on May 6. The city's certified supporters collected enough signatures to get the measure on the ballot on July 28. In October, the Denver Clerk and Recorder's Office mailed out more than 467,000 ballots to city voters, all with the initiated Ordinance 303 language that included the 72-hour enforcement requirements. As of Monday afternoon, 53,515 of those ballots, roughly 11.5%, have been filled out and returned, according to the city. Flicker, on Monday, said he expects the ordinance to pass on Tuesday night, and when it does, he is ready to appeal Shockley's ruling. We're trying to obtain some fairness for Denver residents and property owners who have been saddled with the city's failures to address the homeless crisis. Flicker said in a statement emailed to the Denver Post, "It is unfortunate that the city of Denver would go to these lengths to avoid enforcing its own ordinances." The measure has more than one component. It also would require written permission for any camping on private property and cap the number of city-sanctioned safe camping sites at 4, mandating that each have amenities like restrooms and running water. By invalidating the 72-hour enforcement requirement, Shockley took the teeth out of the measure. It would have granted residents the power to sue the city if officials did not take action against an encampment within that 72-hour window. The Denver City Attorney's Office issued a statement Monday emphasizing that Shockley's ruling does not impact the voting process and that if initiated Ordinance 303 passes on Tuesday, all other subsections of the measure would become law. Denver has great respect for the voter initiative process, but this process is not without its limits and it must be lawful, the office's statement said. TSA, How DIA's Security Lines Will Change This Week, by John Murray, The Denver Post. The Transportation Security Administration plans to reshuffle the types of security screening lanes available at Denver International Airport's 3 checkpoints this week, as both try to reduce wait times during peak periods. And to better handle high parking demand on weekends, DIA said Monday that it would reopen its $8 per day Pikes Peak shuttle lot on Fridays and Saturdays on a recurring basis after recent test runs with its short-staffed shuttle contractor were successful. Both moves mark the latest attempts to get ahead of big crowds at DIA, which is recovering from the pandemic much more quickly than most U.S. airports. Starting Tuesday, 2 new rules of thumb will apply for security screening. Most travelers in need of general screening lanes will be served at TSA's checkpoints at the south end of the terminal on Level 5 and on Level 6 bridge to Concourse A. Travelers with a TSA PreCheck membership or airline premium access status should head to the north checkpoint on Level 5 of the terminal. It will become the default option for TSA PreCheck with multiple dedicated lanes, the Transportation Security Administration says. The changes are coming after TSA and DIA officials conducted a comprehensive review of the security checkpoint operations, according to a TSA news release. In recent months, peak screening times, especially on Sundays and during the morning on Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays, have seen long general screening wait times, with airlines advising passengers to arrive as much as 3 hours before flights. Often, just one pre-check lane was available. Airport and TSA officials hope to standardize the options at each checkpoint as they make do with limited screening capacity while processing more leisure travelers than normal. TSA says the changes will provide more consistent options, though it could make adjustments in response to travel projections. The North checkpoint, which has lost 4 of 12 screening lanes during construction, will now host most of the expedited screening options. It will also have a limited number of general screening lanes, along with one new option for general travelers, a travel light lane, serving passengers with one small carry-on bag, such as a backpack, a briefcase, or a purse. Roller bags won't qualify. Access for clear screening members still will be available at both the south and north checkpoints, but they should choose the south checkpoint if they don't also have pre-check. Until November 10th, though, DIA says the TSA will offer minimal pre-check service in the south area before it's phased out. The only exception to the security reshuffling is that overnight screening will continue to be available only at the 24-hour south checkpoint for all travelers between 9 p.m. and 4 a.m. As for the partially reopened Pikes Peak lot, DIA says passengers using it for weekend flights should give themselves an extra 30 minutes to get to the terminal after parking. Its entrance off East 75th Avenue will be open on Fridays from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. and on Saturdays from 4:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Passengers returning to Denver on other days of the week can still board shuttles to the lot from the terminal's east side on Level 5, Island 3. As the airport's terminal renovation project shifts to the next phase, construction walls are coming down in the terminal's midsection in the next 2 weeks, which would make it easier to get to all of the security screening areas. But volume remains a problem, and DIA CEO Phil Washington recently announced a plan to squeeze 4 temporary screening lanes into the south checkpoint in coming months. This week's changes could bring some measured relief, too. During a time of increasing passenger volumes, coupled with long-term improvements to the airport infrastructure, we worked collectively to develop a path forward that benefits the entire airport community, said Larry Now, TSA's Federal Security Director for Colorado, in the TSA release. We asked travelers to familiarize themselves with screening options at each checkpoint to ensure the smoothest security experience possible. Elijah McClain's death. Officers and paramedics appear in court, by Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. The 3 police officers and 2 paramedics charged with manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide in the 2019 death of Elijah McClain on Monday made their first appearance in court. The 5 men, Aurora police officers Nathan Woodyard and Randy Rodema, former officer Jason Rosenblatt, and paramedics Jeremy Cooper and Peter Sichuniak, all appeared before Adams County District Court Judge Priscilla Lau. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Colorado's safety net health centers are on a fast track to bring more people of color and those living in rural areas into good-paying healthcare jobs. Sarah McCrander with the Colorado Community Health Network says a new grant from SyncUp Colorado will allow health centers to develop staff that are connected to their communities and patients.
Because we know that when people receive care from people that look like them or from the community that they live in, the care and the health outcomes improve.
The Grow Our Own initiative will give clinics tools to connect with youths from historically underrepresented communities and help them make important first steps toward health careers they may not have seen as possible. Anyone interested in joining the program, which will initially focus on recruiting medical assistants, can find more information at missiondrivencareers.org. Nearly 9 in 10 new jobs in Colorado require a post-secondary degree, but just 58% of residents have a professional certificate or college degree. 2/3 of graduates also end up with significant student loan debt. McCrander says by teaming up with colleges and universities, students will be able to earn decent wages as they work toward a range of certificates and degrees.
Say you're a radiology tech and you've done a certification through that you'll be able to apply some of those credits that you earned through that certification program to a future bachelor degree.
Grow Our Own was one of 6 winning partnerships using modern apprenticeships and hybrid college approaches to increase student access to the state's fastest growing industries that pay a living wage, including healthcare and construction. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that some snacking habits can harm your teeth? Snacks and drinks high in sugar can lead to cavities. The sugar in our food becomes acid once it mixes with bacteria found in our mouth. That acid wears away the hard covering of the tooth to create a cavity. Be aware that diet, soda, and drinks don't contain sugar, but the acid in these products erode the enamel, which leads to weakened teeth and cavities. So, what can you do to protect you and your family's teeth? Choose a variety of healthy snack options like whole grain products, milk, cheese, lean meats, fruits, and vegetables. Limit the amount of sugar in your diet and avoid snacking all day. If you have children, talk to them about the effects diet has on the body and their teeth so they can learn to make smart choices for themselves in the future. This message brought to you by DentaQuest, Administrator of Health First Colorado, Medicaid, and the CHP Plus Dental Programs. For information about your DentaQuest dental benefits, finding a provider, or help scheduling an appointment, Health First Colorado members call 1-855-225-1729. Again, that phone number is 1-855-225-1729. TTY711. And CHP Plus members call 1-888-307-6561. Again, that's 1-888-307-6561, TTY711, or visit us at dentaquest.com/Colorado.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado wants to be sure you are conveniently and consistently receiving our broadcast. If you are having any technical issues with your AINC equipment or want to learn about the other options you may have to receive our broadcast, please call us at 303-786-7777, extension 108.